to our next argument, Hershey versus Pacific Investment. Mr. Ruthbird, proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Miles Ruthbird for the appellants. The class that was certified here has two fundamental structural defects. First, it includes both the purchasers and the sellers on the same contracts in a case about whether the price was too high. Second, it includes net gainers as well as net losers from the alleged manipulation. As the 11th Circuit observed in the Valley Drug case cited in the briefs, quote, no circuit has approved of class certification where some class members derive a net economic benefit.
Yes, I don't understand that, because you can't determine in advance who has damages and who doesn't. I mean, in a typical class action, there's some common issues, they're decided, and then be separate hearings for different class members to decide what their damages are, and some of them have no damages. That's nothing wrong with that.
Well, Your Honor, here the issue...
decide all these things in advance.
What needs to be decided in advance, Your Honor, is whether the structure of this class satisfies Rule 23.
No, I'm talking concretely, not in terms of what rules say.
Well, concretely...
What's the sensible economical way to go about this when you have a class? They're all, in a sense, victims of this alleged conspiracy to raise the futures prices. But some of them may actually have gained, and therefore they obviously couldn't have no right to relief. So what's the most practical and inexpensive way of handling a situation of that sort?
The practical and inexpensive way is to have a class definition that does not include so many net gainers as well as net losers. And if Your Honor, please...
So you just want it defined to say net losers? Would that do it? Two words?
No, sir, because that would be a fail-safe class in violation of this court's precedent.
You'll have to explain that.
So, Your Honor, in this particular situation, we submit that the structure of this class, which includes...
Look, what's wrong with just a class definition which says anybody who, sold short and suffered a net loss, sold short during the complaint period and suffered a net loss... Is a member of the class. What's wrong with that?
Because you wouldn't know who's bound until the end of the case.
You wouldn't know who's bound until the end of the case. What does that mean?
Well, if someone is not injured, then they're not, and you determine that at the end of a multi-year process, they would then retroactively drop out of the class.
Well, that's fine. They haven't lost anything. Why shouldn't they drop out of the class?
Well, they should be bound by the class action or not. That's the point of Rule 23.
It's been determined that they didn't lose anything. Well, then obviously they're bound. There's a judgment. They didn't lose anything.
Yes, Your Honor, but they're not part of the class.
Who
so they're,
cares?
They're
they have a judgment. There's a you get a judgment against half of these people. You say these people are entitled to nothing because they were actually net gainers. They should give us money back. Well, that's a judgment, and then you're scot-free. They can't go after you again. So what have you lost?
On that claim, Your Honor. But they wouldn't be bound by res judicata.
Right, they'd be bound by res judicata.
No, sir, they would not be bound
by... If there's a judgment of non-liability, they're bound, obviously.
I'm sorry, sir, they would not be part of the class at that point. They would not be bound by the judgment.
If there's been a determination that they were not injured... That determination will bar them from any future action, won't it?
As a matter of collateral estoppel, perhaps, not res judicata.
Perhaps. If there's a determination that they haven't been injured, how are they going to come back and pester you?
They may have another claim.
What do you mean another claim?
That doesn't turn on the same injury, sir.
But I don't understand you. That a claim outside of the class that because they sold short in a different period, or what? What are you talking about?
Could be, or it could be a common law claim, some state law claim. Could be any kind of claim, and the point of the Sorry.
What gets extinguished? There are no claims. What are you worried about? I don't understand.
Well,
you give me a case of someone who, because of this class definition, someone who's going to, or some way in which you're going to be hurt by someone who, it turns out, doesn't have any damages, but somehow you're afraid he's going to hurt you. So how is he going to do that? I don't get it.
Well, as a practical matter, there will be a class action going forward with an aggregate damages claim, which, of course, we disagree with, but as a practical matter, it will be used as a bludgeon to coerce
settlement. The $636 million, you don't want to put that in a footnote in your 10-K or whatever. No, I understand that. So that's your concern. Now, is there some way to estimate how many of these, 1,000 short sellers were actually, are likely to have incurred a loss?
Well, from the information we have in the record, it appears that a majority of the limited number in the record were net gainers, including one of the two class representatives.
Now, these people, how did you get that information?
It came as a result of the experts coming forward with their methodologies to satisfy predominance, Your Honor.
And he took a sample of these 1,000 sellers?
No, sir. The expert for the plaintiffs tried to do aggregate damages, but as part of the discovery process, there was discovery of a handful of class members.
Who did the discovery of the handful of class members?
Plaintiffs.
They did. You haven't done any.
Correct. And the
why couldn't you pick out 30 members of the class and depose them? Then you'd have a sample, and then you could estimate how many of the class members actually don't belong there.
That's exactly what should happen in our view, Your Honor.
That's what you want to do. You want to depose a sample of the plaintiffs.
Yes, Your Honor.
Of the class members.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can't you do that?
Well, we could. We thought, Your Honor, that the burden was on plaintiffs. We thought we had met our defense burden by showing that the largest class member and one of the two representatives had net gains, and the district court...
That's not a very large sample.
Well, there are only about 7 class members in the record at all, and we believe 5 are net gainers.
But you can get the name, can't you?
No, sir, it's not.
Names and then pick a sample and figure out how.
You might have to get redacted data from the CFTC. I'm sorry.
Could you do that?
We believe so, yes.
So why not do that?
We believe that needs to happen, Your Honor.
Well, why don't you do it? What do you need an appeal for?
Because we felt that the record as it existed did not support this very broad class, and we continue to believe that's true, and the burden's on plaintiffs under Szabo.
What do you want the plaintiffs to do?
We want the plaintiffs to narrow the class definition so it's not so full of conflicts.
And what definition do you want?
We believe that traders who established a short position before May 9, liquidated during the class period, and did not otherwise trade would essentially eliminate the net gainers and reduce the conflicts to a feasible level.
What does it matter whether they also traded?
It matters if they also traded, Your Honor, because the artificiality curve of the plaintiffs goes up and down.
Yes, I know, but they may have traded and they may have had some offsetting gains, but they may still have been net losers.
It's possible, but they're more...
So your definition is no good. You're excluding people who might have sustained losses.
And excluding net gainers, Your Honor.
But you exclude too many. You exclude net losers along with net gainers. Not a good definition. Not a correct definition.
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that there's some sort of balancing test, the plaintiffs have not proposed an alternative, and I was proposing something we thought would address the problem. It's possible there's another definition, Your Honor. Plaintiffs at this point have not proposed one. Your Honor, let me just mention in terms of what is in the record, I mentioned the largest class member, that's a hedge fund called Citadel. They sold $4 billion worth of short position during the class period at inflated prices, according to plaintiffs, and yet this class definition sweeps them in. And so whatever class definition might work, we would say this is too broad, Your Honor. In terms of why can't that be fixed later at the damages phase, we would say it includes too many people who don't have a cause of action. It sets up too many conflicts among class members. This is not like a run-of-the-mill securities class action in that regard because you have such up-and-down movement.
I suppose they accepted not your definition, but some variant which excluded net gainers. So what difference would that make?
If the conflicts in the class were reduced to a manageable level, then there would be adequacy of representation, Your Honor, and predominance, and also compliance with the statutory.
I don't understand. So suppose they change the definition to exclude net losers. Then what do you say? You say it's not $636 million anymore?
That's true, yes.
What do you say?
It depends on the class definition, and we don't know.
Right, you have a class definition. How much is your potential liability under your class definition?
Don't know.
Well, what good does it do you if you don't know what it is?
No, we know it doesn't have conflicts, and we know it's a lot lower.
A lot lower?
Than
That's
the 632.
What you tell your creditors or something? It's a lot lower?
Sure. I see my white light is on, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rothberg. Mr. Lovell?
Thank you, Judge Posner. May it please the Court, Chris Lovell for the respondents. The largest, just to respond to the point at the end, the largest class member is not Citadel. What Citadel did was to deliver. In other words, they didn't actually purchase on the futures market. Our class is defined in terms of people who purchased to liquidate a short position. What Citadel did, when the defendants manipulated the prices up allegedly,
But you have to explain that. Purchased a liquidated.
In other words, here's the way the futures.
Words of one syllable. We're just judges.
Every trade, you judges know way more than I do. I know you're out, but in this one area, I can explain it. Every trade at the end of the day is given up to the clearinghouse. So if you're short, in other words, you sell the futures. 99% of the shorts buy out of the trade. They don't deliver, in this case, a treasury note. They buy out, and it's called a liquidating because you liquidate your obligation to the clearinghouse. So the class is defined as those who bought in order to liquidate a short position. So they don't know. The clearinghouse has one.
And they bought what you contend were at an artificially enhanced price, which reduced their benefit from selling short.
Yes, and that's why the defendants now say it would be no conflict if you limited to people who sold before May 9th, which is when the manipulation began and the artificial prices began to come in. Now, after May 9th, and I'll explain why that's terrible policy and against the private right of action in a minute, but after May 9th, and after prices started to go up to all-time record richness, Citadel sold at the record richness to stop the manipulation from keep going up. We thought they were in a conspiracy with PIMCO. That's why we subpoenaed them during the case. And then they delivered into it. So they did purchase some. They're a small class member for some purchases of some short positions. But basically, they felt it was unjustified to buy back their short position, and they made $8 billion in deliveries, which is more than ever
they
before.
Made money on that?
Yes, they sold.
Why are they in the class?
Only because some of their shorts they did buy back, so they're a small class member, but it's a total distortion of the facts.
But should they be in the class if they don't have net losses?
Judge, I'm not saying they don't have net losses to the extent they're in the class. Their only class member transactions are what they liquidated, what they bought back. So only the short position they bought back. I didn't know this when we did the class motion. We never know it. In all open market trading cases, when we bring the case, we don't know what the profile of artificiality is. We knew from our client, Breakwater, that the richness kept going up, and then it plummeted, and then it went up again. So we do have an up-and-down movement in the richness here. And they did sell at the highest richness, Citadel did, to make the best case for the defense and take my time on that. But they delivered. They only bought a little, and I don't know the net back and forth. So when they bought back their short positions, yes, to that extent, they could be a net gainer on class positions, on class member positions. But they're not a net gainer on the deliveries. The deliveries are not in the class. So no, that's just a total distortion.
But your defendant's position is that, PIMCO's position is that your class is sort of contaminated by containing people who probably were net gainers. Because as you mentioned, there was this period where the futures price actually fell, and you know, depending on when they bought, they might have come out fine.
May I interrupt?
So shouldn't they be purged somehow from the class?
May I interrupt to get the facts straight, and then we can discuss the surgery or perjury or whatever? The facts are not that the futures prices fell. They did fall a little bit, but generally the futures prices went up for the whole period. What changed was the amount of artificiality, or the so-called richness. Artificiality in this case was determined by comparing this futures price, which generally kept going up, but it did dip a little bit, to other prices. And that comparison showed that the richness went way up, went down, then went up again. And that is more dramatic. Now, we didn't know that when we did the class motion. We said we have a common class-wide econometric model through the professor who'd done six, not a consultant, he's a professor, he's done six articles and a book on manipulation. He's used that, and that's what we're using. To say that somebody's a net gainer on artificiality, on the difference between buy and sell, Your Honor, is not such a visible, knowable thing. It's pragmatically, it's not visible or knowable at the start of the case when you do the class motion. You know the prices. The prices are not relevant to this determination. The question is, in other words, somebody who sold before May 9th, to take the easy case, if they didn't buy back at an inflated price, it doesn't matter the difference between the sell and the buy. Similarly, the good citizens after May 9th who reacted to the manipulated market, that's not a time to enter the market. Futures contracts always go down to zero. You don't go in at the end of the market. But the good citizens who went in to stop the manipulated price from going up, they're the ones who are really equilibrating and doing the self-corrective things that the market will do if it's not overpowered by market power. And they're the ones who have the private right of action under the Commodity Exchange Act also to recover their actual damages. The overwhelming majority, not less than half, the overwhelming majority of those new people have damages unless they sold right up at the top, which this Citadel did, and then they got out when it went down. Now, that part of the class, and if they didn't do any other transactions, if they only did that, They just the way the expert report turns out, they are net gainers on the artificiality basis, but not on their purchase and sale differential. I don't know how that will work out.
Wait, no, I've lost you now. They're net losers on the artificiality.
Because on artificiality, Judge, what you do is
are you saying that there's a normal futures price determined competitively, and then there's the conspiratorial or the artificial price. So there's an artificial component to the futures price during the complaint period.
Yes.
Now explain how that affects individual class members.
So at the end of a trial, what you do is you take each class member's purchase and the time of purchase and the amount of artificiality prevailing at the time of purchase, and they're benefiting. Pardon me, they're paying, they're losing by paying that amount of artificiality. However, if they also sold after May 9th, that sale pockets artificiality for them. They sell at an inflated price. And so you compare how much artificiality did they sell to how much artificiality did they buy. And the overwhelming majority bought more than they sold for two reasons. Number one, for most of the period, the amount of artificiality is going up. It crashed down, then it goes up again. But second, the trading greatly diminishes as the class period goes on and almost becomes non-existent for the last 2 weeks when deliveries have begun and most of the people are trading the next future.
What if you had someone who bought, you know, after March 9th, March, May, whatever?
May 9th.
Bought after May 9th, and because of this artificiality, and he sells a few days later, because of this artificiality, he's made a big gain. Now, he's a beneficiary of the conspiracy. So don't his gains have to be netted out in figuring
yes.
what he lost?
Yes, our yes, they do. And which
aren't there going to be a number of people, you know, they sold short, they lost some money, then they bought long, and the price continued to rise because of this artificial effect of a conspiracy. Then they sold. So they made money from the defendant's violations. And don't you have to net that against what they lost by selling short and having
totally.
To cover at a higher...
In every damages phase, you have to look at all the transactions.
Right, but what they complain about is here they're, you know, and they've got this potential liability which could be as exceed $600 million, but if the class were somehow narrowed to eliminate the net gainers, then it would be less of a number.
It's not true at all, Your Honor. First of all, they made $1 billion, but that's not answering Your Honor's question. Your Honor's question really is, you're accepting their premise that by eliminating the net gainers, you eliminate damages. The premise defeats the conclusion. The net gainers don't add the damages at both in the expert opinion, which I'll explain in a minute.
No, I can. If you're 636, whatever figure, if that figure has subtracted the net gains, then it's fine. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
that
totally.
The expert tried to do that.
It's in the record. Unlike in securities where there's no record of open interest, here each day the exchange publishes open interest, and at the end it goes to zero, except for the deliveries. Here the open interest is going down like this. The only damages that go into $630 million are the net change in open interest each day. And each day the net open interest goes down like that. And what the expert did was to apply the artificiality to the net change in open interest, not to the total volume of trading. That's a conservative measure, which the defendants know about for other reasons. And it doesn't use any net gainers to get there. It strains out everything. In securities markets, you have the same problem that's being talked about, Your Honor. You have the problem of people who flip over and go short and do everything else. They're in the class. It's purchasers. They're in the class. And pragmatically, not through perfection, but pragmatically, the class goes forward. But then two protections are in place at the end of the case. Number one, you look at all the transactions and you net it out against this price line of artificiality so they don't have any damages. And number two, anybody who doesn't put in for their damages, they got to show damages, under Van Gemmert versus Boeing Supreme Court case, the money reverts back to the defendants. So they are well, well protected here. And they want to throw out the whole class, Your Honor. And I respectfully submit that the rule of law expresses itself through statutory bank audits, statutory responses to tip-offs of Ponzi schemes, statutory private actions to deter manipulation, and that the stretching of the law here is the wrong move at the wrong time. Judge Guzman quoted all parts of the rule. He quoted SABO. He quoted the standards. He looked at the facts. He kept his docket open to hold this big case, and this has cost a lot of work to him. We've done the whole discovery record, done the summary judgment. None of this involved individual issues. It all turns on three or four interrogatories of the jury. Was there a manipulation? What was the duration? What was the impact? It can be answered in a few interrogatories. If the jury agrees with the plaintiff's damage methodology, we go to a claims procedure where claims are put in, and they'll either be able to prove through a verified claim that they transacted, and they'll either have damages or they won't. It's cost Judge Guzman a lot to do that, and he followed the rules, and the whole class has been done. I don't think that the defendant's positions show any errors in that. Certainly, statutory standing. This is given as their position has evolved into statutory standing. They cite to no securities case, no CEA manipulation case that has ever said, in order to have statutory standing at the start of the case, you've got to show actual damages. That is refuted by this court's statutory standing principles. Statutory standing is an antecedent question to actual damages. It's actually the flip side of the SABO case, which said if you want to have something like personal jurisdiction or something you have to prove, you prove it. I see my white lights on.
Let me ask about conflicts among your class members, Doug. Don't your own experts have some conflicts about the degree of manipulation?
Not at all, Your Honor. Here, on Okay, Rule 23A4 requires adequate representation. It doesn't mention conflicts. Typically, adequate, none of us as overachievers would be happy with adequate. What the defendants get a hold of it, all of a sudden adequate becomes nothing, something none of us can reach. Adequate has been interpreted by this court and others to mean absence of manageable conflicts. And now, there's no theoretical conflict when we're all trying to show a manipulation and do it in a way that'll pass Daubert and put together the evidence and overcome their denials. But now they say, as in every market trading case, there is going to be a conflict because necessarily, as in every market trading case, some people will buy into the market when others are selling. Now they say that those people will have a difference for what they want the expert opinion to show on that day, as happens in every market trading case. In this case, we had two experts. One was a trader from what was called Lehman Brothers, before we didn't have enough deterrence to save people from themselves and unpragmatically let Lehman Brothers go down with this type of argument. And he said, I approach artificiality as false. He had a morning reading when he had all this data. Every day during the class period, May 9th to the end of the class period, he found, based on the morning date at 8 a.m., artificiality. And he gave an amount. He said, mine is not supposed to show the amount exactly, but it gives it at this time. He was not the damages expert. Now we have this Professor Piron I referred to before, who publishes 6 articles on manipulation in the book. He gave intraday readings on price artificiality in order to create the defendants have raised 2 conflicts, one in their first brief and one in their reply. Both are wrong. I was talking to Professor Piron about this yesterday. You'll see in their reply brief, they take the 8 o'clock a.m. reading and they project it back to the close of business the day before. Actually, the market trades during the night, futures does, prices are changing, etc. They say, well, now we're making an apples-to-apples comparison, and that shows a conflict. It's not right. If you look at it at 8 in the morning, there is no conflict. Similarly, on the other conflict, they referred to May 24th and May 25th. If you did an apples-to-apples, there is no conflict. There's in every class action, there's benchmarks and models that people use using separate ways, one from a trading point of view, one from an academic. These professors have shown artificiality every day, and they have a total coincidence, if that's the right word, correspondence of showing the prices moving the same way. There's not a conflict created by this, nor is Professor Merrick's, who used to be the trader, methodology designed to be so good at showing the amount of artificiality, but there is no conflict.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lovell. Mr. Rutherford, how much time does he have? 4 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Our reply brief at pages 25 to 27 summarizes the conflicts in the positions of plaintiff's own experts and within the positions of Dr. Perong, who is one of the experts himself. On the appendix, page 437 and 432, there are 2 different versions of the artificiality curve done by Dr. Perong, the plaintiff's expert himself. For example, one shows artificiality going up from May 26th to May 27th. The other shows it going down from May 26th to 27th. There is no one right answer here. The conflicts do matter, and it's not simply an artificiality curve.
How would you handle that if you were plaintiff?
Sorry, Your Honor?
How would you handle that problem?
Well, I think that some of the CEA cases have tried to handle the problem by separating out the buy and the sell periods so these conflicts are not so severe. And that hasn't been done here, Your Honor.
Well, that sounds like a merits issue. I don't understand your statutory standing issue at all, because you seem to be saying that if someone fails to prove damages, it shows he doesn't have standing, which is...
Sorry, standing for that purpose is the same thing as saying an element of the claim. And it's here loss causation and damages and price artificiality. So it's...
It has nothing to do with standing.
It's been used by some courts as a...
Well, I shouldn't use those words, honestly. It's so confusing.
Understood, Your Honor. Let me just say that the fundamental problem here, and listening to this entire argument, I think it illustrates it, is that the district court did not come to grips with the expert reports or the issues here because...
I don't understand. It seems very premature. This whole appeal seems premature. clearly, they have a case, whether it's a good case or a bad case, nobody knows, that there was manipulation of prices and that people who sold short during this period probably were harmed, most of them, and apparently they have an expert to estimate that. Why isn't that enough to get over the threshold and have a trial where the experts will whack each other and some judgment will come out of it? And if they win, then some fraction of these 1,000 people will receive damages and the others won't.
Your Honor, at a minimum, remand is required because the district court erred on Dura and that affected his analysis of loss causation on pages 8 to 9 of his opinion.
I don't understand. What's this loss causation? If these short sellers were hurt by inflated prices at which they covered, then you've got a standard causal relationship between conduct of your clients and their injury.
They were not hurt if they sold at a higher price than they bought.
Some of them hurt, probably, exactly. Some of them will not be able to prove damages.
The district court didn't get a chance to consider that issue because he concluded
You have no solution to that issue. You have a completely erroneous class definition, and you haven't explained how, as a practical matter, one can determine in advance which of these short sellers was harmed.
Your Honor, respectfully, the district court should be given a chance to evaluate this under the proper standard under Dura, and he did not, as a matter of loss causation, adequacy of representation, and predominance. Footnote 4 of his opinion shows that he considered injury to be created just by buying at too high a price. Dura says that's not injury. You have to consider the sale side.
Well, isn't the CEA a little different, though, than the Securities Act? It says any person violates it regarding any one or more of the transactions. It's a little bit of a loss causation provision.
Your Honor, actually, it refers to actual damages, quote, caused by the manipulation. And then in the next section, which is in the appendix, it says that a person can't bring the claim unless they suffer loss, quote-unquote loss, as a result of the manipulation. And there's no loss here if the person sold at a higher price than they bought. And that's our point, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel. Next, please, for our